This is Front Page Sunday, our weekly news roundup from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. Todd Hatton is away this week. Coming up on the program, we learn how a now 50-year-old medical study has affected the way medical professionals diagnose battered child syndrome. But first, on July 17th, Marshall County will settle an issue that has divided the area for months, whether or not to allow the purchase of alcohol within county lines. The County Chamber of Commerce just released statistics saying that Lyon and Callaway counties experienced some tourism growth after going wet. However, over the past 20 years, dry counties in the Jackson Purchase area also have enjoyed the lowest percentage of DUI convictions per capita. This was compared to wet counties and counties that allowed some alcohol sales. Casey Northcutt, a native of Marshall County, expands the research, looking at a sample of statistics from across the state.
First of all, Marshall County isn't completely dry. The town of Calvert City has a local option to sell liquor by the drink at some restaurants like Los Tres Amigos. Amigos manager Jessica Soto would like to sell margaritas on Sundays. Helping to run one of the two restaurants in Marshall County that sell alcohol, she knows the switch from a damp city to a wet county could improve her business.
We have so many people that come in on Sundays and they're always, do you serve alcohol on Sundays? And we have to tell them no. And a lot of times people, they leave. They go somewhere else and they drive 20, 30 minutes away to have some drinks just to drive all the way back.
But will that extra alcohol jeopardize the safety of Marshall County streets? Will the benefit to Los Tres Amigos and other businesses outweigh any heightened risk of drunk drivers? To answer these questions, I did some digging. I compared six counties possessing populations within 10,000 residents of Marshall's. Looking at the latest information, I picked three wet counties to compare to Marshall, along with two other counties that offer no or limited sales. Using Kentucky State Police reports, I looked at county alcohol-related collisions, DUI convictions, and total crimes. The findings were a little confusing. The wet counties typically had higher drunk driving collision rates in 2006 and 2010, but Marshall County, a county that offers limited sales, had the highest overall. The reverse was true for DUI convictions in 2010. Also, dry counties and counties with limited alcohol sales typically had lower crime rates in 2006, but no definitive pattern developed for 2010. I hit a dead end in my research. But Marshall First, the organization pushing for alcohol sales, did not.
We had an increase in sales of $19 million.
That's Jody Lassiter, president, CEO of the Danville-Boyle County Economic Partnership, talking about the money Danville businesses have made from alcohol beverage sales. Marshall First cites the city's success as an example. Danville went wet in 2010.
During that same period of time, the city of Danville collected alcohol license fees in the amount of $600,000, for which they have applied to enforcement of the ABC code, which is primarily targeted to alcoholic beverage control, as well as public safety. So it's actually added two new positions to our police force.
Lassiter goes on to say that since Danville businesses have started selling alcohol, the police have experienced no increase in DUIs and no great increases in crime rates or penalties. In fact, the city received $900,000 in tax revenue from alcohol sales that it uses in part for alcohol abuse education. Conversely, opposing organizations Say No Now points to both national and local numbers that indicate negative effects of alcohol on economy and safety. According to a study published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, excessive drinking in the United States cost taxpayers $21 billion in criminal justice expenses in 2006. According to Keith Travis, vice chair of Say No Now, if alcohol is guaranteed to boost an economy, it sure didn't work in Fulton County.
Fulton County became the county in Kentucky with the highest single unemployment level in the Commonwealth. If alcohol was the cure for all evils of economic woes, Fulton County, we wouldn't think, would be in that position.
Fulton County also has one of the lowest county populations in the state. After those interviews, I went back to the Kentucky State Police reports. Because traffic problems are hot issues, I honed in on DUI convictions and alcohol-related collisions. After omitting the six counties with populations more than 100,000, I looked at numbers from the remaining 114. I found the top 10 counties for DUI convictions in 2010. Five were wet, and five offered limited sales. Then I looked at alcohol-related collisions and finally found a difference. In 2010, seven of the top 10 counties for alcohol-related collisions were wet. The other three only allowed some sales. That might be a telling statistic. Counties that sold the maximum amount of alcoholic beverages commonly had more collisions than counties that limited their alcoholic merchandise. Yet when I asked Kentucky State Police Captain David Jude to make sense of the numbers, he said they might not be the most important issue. Adequate law enforcement and alcohol education, he said, should be priorities, no matter what decision Marshall County residents make.
I think it's hard to say simply looking at the numbers. I mean, it's good for comparison to try to get an idea, but as you're seeing there, when you look at the data, you're finding that just because a county does not sell alcohol does not mean that they're exempt from having DUI-related offenses.
Maybe the statistics don't matter quite as much as whether or not the county will maintain its efforts to control drunk driving. Whether or not Los Tres Amigos sells margaritas on Sundays, its customers should know that the police will be waiting on the streets outside, doing their best to keep Marshall's collision numbers low. For WKMS News, I'm Casey Northcutt.
Local musician and Murray State graduate student Kirk Raper felt a bit of a culture shock when he moved from the Nashville area to Callaway County and found that the closest place to buy packaged alcohol was across the state line. This inspired him to write a commentary in the form of a song titled The Dry County Blues. Please note the views expressed in this commentary or song are solely those of the contributor and do not necessarily reflect the views of WKMS.
When I first moved into town, I decided to go for a cruise. Stepped into the convenience store, said, "Where can I buy some booze?" The clerk looked at me funny like I wasn't from around. She said, "You're gonna have to drive to Tennessee on down. Although they sell it in the bars before midnight's through, all you can do is join the crew and sing the Dry County Blues." Aww. So now I've got the Dry County Blues. Guess that means the Bible Belt is winning in this county prohibition. I've got the Dry County Blues. Well, I finally settled in and stocked up with Jack and Jim. I'd never wanna see my bottles empty gone again. But I bought a bit too much and found I got too liquored up. Because it's hard to find a balance when you got so much. I kept beer, wine, and rum for any night to have fun. But we drank it all up and had to make another run. Got the Dry County Blues. Lord, I got the Dry County Blues. And you wouldn't find it funny if the same thing happened to you. And one day out on the road, a friend had some good news. The county just overpassed a law to sell some booze. And one day it finally happened. The store had opened up, and it was just across the river, not too far to fill my cup. Now I wouldn't have to buy so much, and I could get straight. Somehow I knew it wouldn't last. There was another twist of fate. There was a cargo ship from NASA passing through the county line. The bridge's lights were out, and it just couldn't stop in time. They were in the wrong channel. It doesn't matter the reason, but it broke the Egna Ferry Bridge, and crossing won't be easy. Guess it's back to Tennessee or up to Paducah Town. Because I can't buy booze in Callaway County. Got the Dry County Blues. Lord, I got the Dry County Blues. And you wouldn't find it funny if the same thing happened to you.
Kirk Raper is a Callaway County resident working on his master's degree in water science at Murray State. Hear this song again on our website, WKMS.org. Battered Child Syndrome turned 50 this month. In 1962, the Journal of the American Medical Association published this groundbreaking study, which broadened the term child abuse to include child maltreatment, encouraged the development of child protective service agencies, and changed the way physicians cared for children with injuries. Pediatric forensic expert Dr. Melissa Curry is only one of two physicians in Kentucky specializing in child abuse. Dr. Curry is the medical director of pediatric forensic medicine at the University of Louisville. She talks to WKMS's Heidi Couch about the continued need for awareness.
How has the medical field progressed to identify child abuse? I think that that's a great question, and I think it has varied to some degree state by state. In some places in the country, they have had child abuse recognition now as part of their medical school curriculum for decades. Here in Kentucky, we have only just in about the last 6 or 7 years ensured that every medical student, at least at the University of Louisville, receives training about child abuse recognition. There are more continuing education offerings out there about child abuse recognition and reporting. And then I think just having the board certification and the recognition that this is a complex field and that we do need people to specialize in it has raised awareness among pediatricians and other medical providers that this is important, it happens a lot, and there are resources to help you identify and sort through what might be going on with a patient.
One part of this report that was published in reflection of the 50 years since the original publication, if I could just read this for you, approximately 78% of cases were substantiated as neglect, with only 18% as being physical abuse. Is there a difference between neglect and abuse? I feel like people may not respond to neglect the same that they would respond to physical abuse.
Yes, there is certainly a difference. They are both two different kinds of child maltreatment, so they fall under the child maltreatment umbrella. I think in our communities, the folks who are the best at identifying neglect and calling that into CPS is our schools and our teachers, because they see the children every single day, and they oftentimes are the ones that are sensitive enough to recognize those signs.
I think you're absolutely correct in that it's not every day that a child goes into a physician's office, but it hopefully is every day that they step into a schoolroom.
That's exactly right.
One part of this study did mention noticing the difference between maybe how a patient comes in, a child comes into the office and presents their history versus what the physical signs tell the physician. Has there been progress on that aspect?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of it is just a matter of sharing case examples and helping folks understand. I mean, for example, it seems, I think, intuitively reasonable to us that if a child fell down a flight of stairs, that they would have multiple bruises. It turns out, though, that when you do the studies, that's not the case. Typically, a child will come out of it with no injuries at all, and if they have any visible injuries, it tends to just be one or two bruises. So by doing the rigid scientific analysis of these things that we need to understand, we're learning what really is reasonable from a certain event and what is not reasonable injury from a certain event. And we're doing our best to disseminate that information to the people who are on the front lines making those judgments.
Person who's not a physician or not in the medical field comes across a child, is there any advice for them about identifying maybe somebody who, a child who's been abused, or how they should move forward? Considering that there's only two or three of you physicians out there doing this, it really seems like it's kind of up to the general public.
Yes, that's true to a large degree. Some tips that I often offer regarding recognition of abuse is a bruising rule, and it's called the 10-4 rule. 10 is spelled T-E-N, and the T stands for torso, E is ears, and N is neck. So any bruising of the torso, ears, or neck in a child under 4 years of age, so that's the 4 part of the rule, or any bruising anywhere in a child 4 months of age or younger. So that 10-4 rule is something that we can carry with us and keep in mind, so that should we see injury on children out in our, you know, our general day-to-day lives, we have some way to distinguish normal bruising from not normal bruising. And then calling that case into social services or law enforcement is not only the right thing to do, but also the legally required thing to do.
How do you identify a normal bruise from an abusive bruise? You may hear often, oh, I just fell, and that fall really is not, may not be a fall, but I would think that some people would be a little apprehensive or a little nervous about notifying somebody.
You're exactly right. It can be very tricky and very difficult to distinguish between the two for folks who don't have special training in this. And that is why the way the law is written and the way that we recommend folks approach this is that calling CPS because you have a concern is not the same thing as saying that you're certain a child is being abused. If you're waiting until you're certain, you're waiting too long and we're going to miss children who have been abused.
Well, again, I really appreciate your time and speaking with us about this issue. 50 years, you can make a lot of progress, but it seems like there's still some work that needs to be done.
Absolutely.
Heidi Couch spoke with University of Louisville pediatric forensic expert Dr. Melissa Curry. When we come back, a conversation with State Senator Perry Clark about his push to legalize medical marijuana in Kentucky. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe. Coming up, we'll hear about a push to legalize hemp and medicinal marijuana in the Commonwealth. But first, did you know Kentucky has a hemp museum? In fact, it's looking to make Christian County its new home, which is once a hotbed of industrial hemp growth. WKMS's Drew Adams spoke to Kentucky Hemp Museum Director Katie Moyer about the move to the purchase, the uses of hemp, and why it's different from its psychoactive cousin, marijuana.
The Kentucky Hemp Museum, as it is right now, is a van. It's a rather large van. It's been gutted on the inside, so it's just seats in the front. And the back of it is full of hemp memorabilia, some history, photos, and things like that made out of hemp. So it's kind of a mobile museum. So what we're doing now is looking for a permanent home for it. And here in Christian County, we've got a lot of support for growing industrial hemp from our elected officials. And we've got a bunch of empty buildings here in Christian County.
To the layperson that would say, why, number one, do we need a museum for industrial hemp? And number two, why would we need industrial hemp in the first place? Like, why would people in Christian County support it? What would you say?
As far as why we need a museum, industrial hemp has been around for thousands of years. It's been around probably longer than humans have. The use of hemp goes as far back as 8,000 years. Kentucky's history of industrial hemp goes back to when we colonized this area, before Kentucky became a state. When the settlers moved to this region, they brought hemp seed and they were sowing hemp seed with them as they went. It's as much a part of our history in Kentucky as horses or bluegrass or anything, but we don't realize. And the goal of having the museum is to educate people about Kentucky's history. We grew 96% of the country's hemp at one point just in this state. We are the nation's leading producer of hemp, not marijuana, just industrial hemp. And the icing on the cake on that is really that the hemp sterilizes any marijuana that's grown around it, which is why we have so much support from our sheriff's office here and our judge executive and our state representatives, because it's actually going to help fight the drug war.
How does that work? I didn't know that was actually the case.
There's a chemical in the hemp that keeps the THC level to extremely low levels, where with marijuana you typically grow it for something like 7 to 25% THC. Industrial hemp has less than 0.03% THC. And the chemical that keeps the THC low in the hemp, because they are related, does cross-pollinate with the marijuana, and it actually lowers the THC level in the marijuana.
Is there any existing governmental body that would disassociate hemp from the drug-bearing marijuana plant?
No, I don't think there's any governmental agencies that actually distinguish the two. What's interesting, though, is that several states have legalized marijuana for medicinal purposes, but no state has legalized hemp. There's a gentleman that's working on another museum. It's actually for architecture in Christian County, but we're brainstorming on how we could incorporate hemp into that building, being that it's been used for bridges and architecture for thousands of years, the hemp concrete.
Hemp concrete?
Yeah, actually, you can just very simply mix the broken up stalk with lime and water. It creates a concrete-like material made from hemp that actually petrifies over time. With concrete, you have something that lasts a few years and then starts to crack. Hemp concrete actually petrifies over time. So instead of something that lasts like 40 to 50 years, you have a structure that lasts 500 years. In fact, there's bridges in France that were built hundreds of years ago that are still standing. They were built with only hemp concrete.
Drew Adams spoke with Kentucky Hemp Museum Director Katie Moyer. After learning more about Kentucky's hemp history, could Kentucky be the next state to legalize the medicinal use of marijuana? State Senator Perry Clark hopes so. He's pre-filed the Gatewood-Galbraith Medical Marijuana Memorial Act. The bill is named after the late perennial gubernatorial candidate who campaigned on legalizing marijuana. Kentucky Public Radio's Philip Bailey spoke with Senator Clark on his podcast, Noise and Notes. Here's a portion of that interview.
Why this and why now?
The time has come. We're at a tipping point in the United States of America. You know, as many as 74% of the American public believe that medical marijuana should be allowed. About 54%, 56% believe that marijuana itself should be decriminalized. We're at the tipping point. 18 states, plus the District of Columbia, have medical marijuana laws. And even the District of Columbia law had to be signed into effect by Mr. Obama. So, you know, we know this is out there. We're at a tipping point. Virtually every state that surrounds us is currently working on a medical marijuana bill. And, you know, and Kentucky needs to get up on the forefront of this. You know, there's a lot of economic benefits to doing this. And it truly is a medicine. That's what we're really dealing with here. The Federal Drug Food and Drug Administration says that marijuana has no medicinal values. That is their statement. But really, what we're looking at, if that is the statement that they're making to us, why does the United States government hold the patent for medical uses of the cannabis plant? There's a patent number, 663-0507. It is a United States patent number held by the National Institutes of Health for all the medical uses of marijuana.
So what's the resistance to it then? I mean, it seems that proponents have a pretty cogent argument about this. Why have state legislators in some states, some more than others, been resistant to the idea of at least making medical marijuana legal?
I think what you have to look at is the voters. And so you're dealing with a political reality here. And what we have in the United States is over 60 years of lies and propaganda surrounding the medical marijuana plant. Marijuana has been, historically, it's been, we know, 2,900 years of medicinal history. It was the number one, two, and three prescribed drug by doctors until almost 1900. And it works for many, many things. When the petrochemical, pharmacal, petri dish creators of medicine came out, that's really got the marijuana swept away. And that's probably the underlying biggest cause of it at all. There's lots of reasons, and there's so many nuances, and this thing is a Hydra monster on why it was made illegal.
I've seen polling that shows that the majority of people do sort of favor legalization on some level, whether of marijuana altogether or
yes.
Medical marijuana, but just because the people believe something, when it gets into the machine of government, is this likely to go anywhere in Frankfurt? I mean, it didn't before. Do you think this go round, this round?
Here's the only thing that makes it likely, Philip, is the people. And the people have the power of the democracy. And if people would educate themselves, and we're calling this Education Summer, and we're asking people to look at the data that is available.
I want to ask you a personal question, though.
Yes.
Do you smoke marijuana?
That's not a very good question. That is an absolute distraction. I will tell you I'm a 70s child. I'm a veteran that they put in all the Oriental
countries in the 1970s. You named the act after Gatewood Galbraith.
Yes, I did.
And Gatewood was very open and honest about it.
When
I interviewed him, he said, yes, I do. I have seen no problem with that. I do when I,
that's
when I need
right.
to, and
he
I don't when
since
I don't need
he was
to.
An asthma for a child. I do not in general. My doctor has recommended medical marijuana for me. I have chronic back pain. I'm on a standing prescription for about 8 hydrocortisone a day, hydrocortisone and 6 Flexeril. Could you imagine anyone taking that much medication? I would be pretty much basically a zombie. So no, I kind of live with my pain. I don't like the illegality of it. I cannot get it from medicine. I have been known to smoke marijuana. I'm not afraid of marijuana. It's a whole lot less problems involved with marijuana than alcohol. There's no bad side effects. The government has studied that, and we've got some great studies of that by the National Institute of Health. There's very little that can damage you with smoking some marijuana.
You sort of see it in the same way that people have compared it to prohibition. Compared to alcohol.
That's exactly what it is. And if you look at the history of prohibition, you look at the history of alcohol, it's really interesting because Henry Ford intended for Fords to be run out of hemp oil. He intended to, and he made plastic hemp. He thought you could almost grow a car instead of being dependent on the oil and everything. And he thought you would run that out of it. But you had to take the hemp seed and to make basically an ethanol out of it, which is an alcohol. And the Rockefellers, who wanted cars to be run out of oil, gave over $4 million to the Temperance League. And they gave it to the churches to lie to the people and to sweep prohibition in. Prohibition was an absolute mess in the United States. The residual went on and on. Prohibition of a seed, a God-given natural seed that you put in the ground and you grow it for food, you grow it for fiber, you grow it for fuel, you grow it for medicine, it's an anathema that that's prohibited. It's an anathema to everything this country is about.
Now, what
it's
about those who
freedom,
argue—
to liberty, to compassion, to justice?
Because I know that there's already been some pushback.
There's going to be lots of arguments.
When we first posted up your story,
sure,
we got some pushback from some young Republicans in the city of Louisville,
uh-huh,
who argued that, you know, this is disgraceful, I guess, to have an illegal drug being pushed by a state legislator. There are some, it's still some violence associated
that's
with—
That's a ridiculous
distraction. But there's still some violence associated with the drug trade. But I guess what you're saying is that the same thing with alcohol, if we make it legal, why not just push for legalization, period?
That's actually what needs to be happening. I think that's inevitable, and that's absolutely correct. I think that's where you need to go, is free the whole seed for all of its many uses. I think you'll find, as we liberalize in all the best senses of the word, our marijuana laws and actually our drug laws. If you look at what happened in Portugal, and most people don't understand the Portugal model, they're a Christian, conservative nation, Catholic nation. They had one of the worst drug problems in the world. What they did, they didn't know what to do finally, and they had the same kind of war on drugs we have, useless, waste of money, incarcerate everybody, and they decriminalized all drugs. Not just at all drugs. And for every indicator you could look at that you wanted to see a positive effect on, they had a positive effect on. Adult drug use, down. Teenage drug use, down. Prison population, down. Crime, down. A lot of the problems with our prohibition, and it's the same with the alcohol prohibition, is you allow all the money on the black market. You know, you allow that to come to the service, let it be done, put a taxation policy into it. And it's not just about people that want to smoke weed or people that, under necessity and under their own conscience, want to do medical marijuana for medicinal and healing
purposes. I'm sure you were aware probably earlier this year, maybe you did, but earlier this year, a constituent contacted Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell,
mm-hmm,
about legalizing marijuana, and the senator said, told the constituent in a February 14th letter that he has serious concerns about legalizing marijuana for medical purposes. And he's also troubled by the fact that many legalization proposals would make marijuana available to the public without following the scientific processes. And he also warned that marijuana leads to death.
Lord have mercy. That is the biggest bunch of trite. There is not one recorded death from marijuana in the history of mankind.
Let me quote him specifically. In his letter, he says, quote, "The detrimental effects of drugs have been well documented. Short-term memory loss, loss of core motor functions, heightened risk of lung disease, and even death." So you disagree with that?
Yes, that is all a lie, and I have the documentations and the research study that prove none of that is true. That is the old fear that we use to keep people under control and make them have to think very good. During the education summer, we're going to expose all these documents. We have these studies that were done by NIH, and they did them in several different nations on the impairment of medical marijuana. Not medical marijuana, just the regular smoking of marijuana for recreational uses and enjoyment. They found no impairment, no impairment in brain function, no lung conditions. There's never been an issue of one person ever contracting cancer, lung cancer, from marijuana. These are not facts. These are opinions and fear tactics. There is so much evidence that refutes everything the senator says.
Are you at all worried about, you're pretty bold. I mean, you're very passionate about this issue, obviously.
And lots of issues. We've talked about other issues.
Exactly.
And I don't back up on them either.
But on this, you're doing this in the midst of an election year.
Yes, and that had nothing to do with it, honestly.
Clearly. I mean, because some people would say that this would be certainly something that an incumbent politician wouldn't want to bring up.
And all of my so-called handlers and campaign people are, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? The time has come. We're at the tipping point. And Kentucky needs to get on the point of this spear. We need to part. We need to benefit from this. You know, we fight over hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm telling you, a clear policy of decriminalization of marijuana and medical marijuana, you're gonna reduce your prison population, you're gonna save money, you're gonna not break up your families, which you do with the policy that we have. It's a terrible thing. You know, we had a good friend, MS sufferer, and through a weird fluke, the police caught him growing some marijuana. And they came and took his children away. Now, that's barbaric for someone to have MS, and they do medical marijuana, no one knows. No one knows but them. None of their neighbors know. Nobody knows. It was really fluke that they even found it because they were looking for a bank robber's bag he threw out, and they got close to his house, and they found weed. That's barbaric and wrongheaded. We need to change these laws. It's time.
Senator Perry Clark, keeping the memory Gatewood Galbraith Alive Center. Thank you for
God
joining us.
God bless Gatewood. Thank you, Philip.
Kentucky Public Radio's Philip Bailey speaking with Senator Perry Clark about the Gatewood Galbraith Medical Marijuana Memorial Act from his podcast Noise and Notes. You can find a link to Noise and Notes at WKMS.org.
Almost busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose. But if you're staying in a motel there in Lee, don't leave nothing in your clothes. Airport in Milwaukee, they refused to let us board the plane at all. They said we looked suspicious, but I believe they like to pick on me and Paul. And on a package show in Buffalo.
Next, we kick off our WKMS Youth Radio Project with an interview by 9-year-old Murray Elementary School student Patrick Jones. He recently attended a basketball camp organized by Murray State men's basketball head coach Steve Prohm. He scored a few minutes with Prohm to talk about the Racers' upcoming season and the celebrated ice cream shot.
I'm Patrick Jones here at the CFSB Center talking with Murray State University head basketball coach Mr. Steve Prohm. Good afternoon, coach.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well today. I've had a lot of fun this week in your basketball camp. Why did you start the camp, and what do you hope the campers get out of it?
You know, this is my going in my second year as a head coach. I was Coach Kennedy's camp coordinator for the last, really, for 12 of my 13 years with him. So, you know, I enjoy camp. It's an opportunity to get to know the kids in this area. And really for our players, it's an opportunity for them to give back and get to know you guys a little bit better and have a close relationship.
Okay, I already know the answer to this question. But for kids listening who don't know, what is the ice cream shot, and have you made one yet?
Good question. The ice cream shot is a shot that the camp counselor, the camp coordinator, whoever's running the camp that week, shoots from three-quarter court, from the opposite free throw line. And if he makes it, the whole camp gets ice cream on that Thursday at the end of camp. Over my 12, 13 years of camp, I probably made maybe 10 or 12, a dozen. There's a couple camps that haven't made it, but there's sometimes when you make it, it's a really great atmosphere and kids are running and a lot of pandemonium.
Do you do the same kinds of drills with the racers that we are doing in the camp this week?
You know, some people will be surprised for me to tell you that, yeah, we do. Some of the same things we do with our guys, especially a lot of the stretching, a lot of the form running things that we do in the early morning period, a lot of the fundamentals we'll incorporate into our practice. And then when we do station work with you guys, a lot of things from a basic level, they may do it a little bit more from an advanced level, but the basic fundamental stuff is the same.
The Racers had a great season last year. How do you think the Racers will do next year?
We'll find out. No, I think we'll have a great team. We've got great leadership with Isaiah Cannon, Ed Daniel, two of our seniors. We've got an upperclassman team. We've got five seniors in all. And then we got Dexter Fields as a junior. We returned six of our top nine guys. So the biggest thing we got to do is get our chemistry right and go from there. And looking forward to a very, very exciting season.
Three great Racers graduated, Juwan Long, Ivan Aska, and Dante Poole. But you also gained some good players. How's this new team coming together?
Well, we haven't had an opportunity to be together really yet. We've only got a couple players on campus right now. Everyone gets here July 1st. We'll have all 13 guys on campus July 1st. And the first thing that I'll try to do with them and our staff will try to do with them is get our team chemistry together. The biggest thing I thought made us successful last year was our chemistry. So we want to get our chemistry right and then work on developing them from a basketball standpoint, strength and conditioning, and then individual workouts.
Do you think we'll make the Sweet 16 this year?
Well, that's our goal. Our first goal is to win the conference championship. We want to win the regular season conference championship, put us in a great position to get a great seed for the conference tournament championship, win that, and then get in the tournament. Hopefully we'll get a good seed, and our goal is to take the next step, and hopefully that means an appearance in the Sweet 16.
What's the team's biggest challenge, and who will be your toughest opponent this season?
Our biggest challenge as a team is not just living in last year, is moving on, and this is going to be a new team. It's a new year. We start 0-0. We've got to work the same way from a preparation standpoint. We've got to change some things we did offensively a little bit so we don't just stay the same. And then we've got to get our chemistry. You know, I talked about our chemistry earlier. We've got to get our chemistry right and get everybody to buy into their roles, and I think we can have a great year.
One last question. When you make the next ice cream shot, what flavor will you get?
Well, usually we get the ice cream sandwiches, the vanilla ice cream sandwiches is what traditionally we get. We can change it if you want to change it. Hopefully, Marcus only has 3 hours tomorrow to make it, so we'll see.
See a slideshow of Patrick at Steve Prohm's basketball camp at WKMS.org, along with a gallery of good reads for kids. Special thanks to Patrick's dad, Rusty Jones, for coordinating the interview. If your child has an interest in youth reporting, please send us an email to msu.wkms@murraystate.edu. After the break, we'll hear about the last chance for the public to provide input on how Land Between the Lakes could deal with a nearly $850,000 cut to their maintenance budget. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe. In April, Land Between the Lakes officials announced the park's federal maintenance budget had been reduced by 50%. The total loss amounted to about $800,000 for the park. Over the past few months, we've been following the efforts of local Forest Service officials as they try to determine how to best deal with those cuts. The process involves seeking public input at several meetings around the park, as well as an online questionnaire. Now, the public has a final chance to give their input to park administrators before they make the final decision on changes in August. Shelley Baskin spoke with LBL customer service manager Brian Beisel about what the results of the public survey were and what the future looks like for LBL.
Brian, we've been following these budget reduction discussions for a while. Can you tell me where you're at in the process right now?
What we've done is we've posted on our website a way to provide the public an opportunity to provide feedback on the proposals before a final decision is made. So they have from July 11th through August 1st in order to look at the information and provide us feedback on the proposals. Now, there are three tables to look at in those, and we're really interested in table A, which is things we're going to implement at the time that this process is finished after August 1st. What we're really looking for is new information. All of these ideas have been displayed before the public prior to this, but we're looking for new information and specific to each proposal. We know there's people that don't like some of these things. We don't like some of these choices that we have to make, but it's a way for them to have one more look at what we're proposing to do to meet the budget that we have to work with so that we didn't miss anything.
Well, I know that you had plans of asking people for comment online, but that stage is finished. Is this newest round of comments something you decided to add later?
This was added as another final opportunity, just, again, to make sure we didn't miss any information or perhaps someone hadn't responded. They're seeing now which of the ideas we intend to implement, so we wanted to give the public one more chance.
So what kind of feedback have you received? Is it about what you expected to hear from the public?
Sure. Well, we heard some very specific messages from the public. 69% of the responses we got supported fee increases, and that lined up with the fact that the public really doesn't want to lose any services that LBL or any offerings that we have. So they were willing to support, you know, reasonable fee increases. They also, we had about half of the folks that supported road closures. Now, we're not talking about access to cemeteries. I want to be very clear on that. But if there was a low-used road and we could demonstrate that to the public, you know, there was some support for that. So we really listened to what the public said, and we built our choices around their preferences. So they came up with the ideas, and then we knew what they had told us they didn't want to lose, what was important to them. And so we had a small team that developed recommendations for Bill Lisowski to make those choices, and that's how that was all developed.
So once you've gotten through this last stage, what's the timeline for implementing the changes?
Well, there of the approximately 100 ideas that we want to move forward with, 54 of them are in Table 1, and we plan to make a decision on those shortly after the feedback ends on August 1st. 11 of the ideas are already underway. They're already something we're already implementing because they were good ideas and we thought, why wait? And they weren't controversial, and so we went ahead on those. There's a few that are deferred plans, if something, we don't know what future budgets look like, so we have to have some deferred backup plans. For example, we have a feed tube we put in our rifle range that's voluntary. If that doesn't work, we may have to make sure that we may have to institute a fee for use there. That would be one example. And then 24, the idea is we want to study a little bit further, and so it's going to take us a little bit longer. So, but the 54 in Table A are the ones to be looking at in the feedback process.
Well, I guess the big question is all of this work going to pay off? Do you think the park will be sustainable for the near future?
We do believe that. You know, we've talked with a lot of folks, congressional folks, that we have a good feel for where the budget for the Forest Service is going for the next few years, and we feel that we are aligning ourselves or preparing ourselves for, you know, what the future budget looks like. So we think we're going to come through this just fine.
Brian Beisel is the customer service manager for Land Between the Lakes. He's helping guide the feedback process for the budget cut discussions. Brian, thanks for joining me today.
You're welcome.
The trial began this week for Jerry Wayne Walker Jr., the man implicated in a fatal 1998 Murray State University dorm fire. Walker was originally charged in 2001 in connection with the fire that killed then-student Michael Minger. That trial ended in a hung jury. Kentucky State Police reopened the investigation a couple of years ago and brought charges against Walker again this past September. This week, jurors have heard evidence presented by the prosecution. Candace Freeland is covering the trial for the West Kentucky Star. She joins Gary Pitts to talk about what happened this week.
What have they been doing this week, the prosecution? Have they been just kind of laying groundwork, or is there a particular angle that they're going for? What have they been doing?
Well, I would agree with that statement. It has been a lot of laying the groundwork. And then on Thursday, things got particularly meaty, if you will, and got pretty testy as well. We heard recordings of Jerry Walker's interview with Kentucky State Police back in November of 1998, and it was fascinating, to say the least. He was speaking with Detective Don Wood, and he didn't mince words with Jerry Walker, told him that if you have anything you need to say to me, you need to do it now, because he had already submitted one handwriting sample to Kentucky State Police, and it came back as indicating that an anonymous note that Walker found on his windshield regarding events of the fire and kind of pointing the finger at someone else came back that he wrote that note. That was according to lab analysis. Investigator Don Woods presented him with this information, and he said, no, I didn't write that note, said that repeatedly. So finally, Jerry Walker submitted a second handwriting sample, and Don Woods at that point said, I'm telling you now, if you have anything you need to say, say it, because if this second sample comes back positive, I'll have no mercy on you. Well, the interview ended soon after that. Then it came back. Don Woods said it was at Jerry Walker's request that the recording had been restarted, and then Jerry Walker admitted that he did write the anonymous note that he himself found on the windshield of his car. He said he did it, and he pointed the finger at John Eveland, who later married Walker's former girlfriend, not to get him into any sort of trouble, but rather he just, you can presume that he wanted to shake him up a bit, because he had been upset by this man's involvement with his on-again, off-again girlfriend, and he admitted to that.
And how about Friday? What did they present on Friday?
So Thursday was really kind of the highlight in terms of the intensity of the witnesses. And then Friday, it's been pretty exciting as well, especially if you're a student of science. Greg Gorbett testified, and he is an arson and explosion analyst, testified to the amount of gasoline that it would take to produce the thermal damage that was done to the fourth floor of Hester Hall and the amount of time it would take. Is it consistent with witness statements? Is it consistent with evidence found at the scene? And after 11 tests, they determined that it would take one half to 1 gallon of gasoline to produce the damage that was done to the fourth floor of Hester Hall back in September of 1998, and that the hallway would be filled with smoke within 20 seconds, and that it would go completely dark within 30 seconds. And that, he said, is consistent with witness statements, making it very difficult to maneuver and find your way around and to get out safely. And it also is consistent with the fact that Jerry Walker Jr. purchased just over a gallon of gasoline the night of the fire. So it's been a very interesting week. And, you know, really, Gary, a lot of this evidence, what I have gathered this week from an observer standpoint, there's a lot of circumstances here that could go either way. But in terms of hard evidence, placing him here, placing him there, it's really difficult to do that. And no one has at this point come forward and said, I saw Jerry Walker do this.
Right.
And that even goes back to the attendant at the gas station. All she can definitively say is that he did purchase gas around 2 o'clock in the morning. He did purchase the package of Twizzlers, but she herself said that she never saw him put gasoline in any sort of container. So there's a lot of circumstances here that could go either way. It's been an interesting case so far, and Friday closed out the first day, and it'll go into this week.
Candace Freeland, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you, Gary.
Candace Freeland is a reporter for the West Kentucky Star. She's been covering the Jerry Wayne Walker trial in Marshall County, which will resume this week. It's been 10 years since Murray's Angels Attic Thrift Shop opened its doors with the help of donated space and $20,000 of seed money. The sale of donated, gently used items helped to support the Angels Community Clinic, which provides health services for Murray's uninsured. Drew Adams reports on how the clinic has helped one person and tells us more on the thrift shop's impact on the health of Murray's uninsured.
Kathy Turner is in a unique situation. She works for Angels Attic, but can't afford health insurance. So when she noticed she wasn't feeling quite like herself, she followed the advice of her coworkers and went to the clinic her work supports, where she was diagnosed with diabetes.
It was a shock to me. It wasn't like it would be a horrible diagnosis like some people have received, but for me, it was, you know, heart-wrenching in a way.
While the diabetes diagnosis was helpful, it led to another problem, the continued cost of her health care. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the average yearly cost for the treatment of diabetes is more than $13,000.
I wouldn't have any choice. I would have to, if they didn't give me the strips, if I didn't have them, I would not be able to keep track of how is the medicine working. I would have to simply not eat. I couldn't afford it.
Once again, the clinic stepped in. Turner, who cannot afford the medication, testing strips, and doctor visits, receives all of these supplies and services from the Angels Clinic for free. And Kathy isn't the only person in the Murray area who gets help from the Angels Attic and Clinic. Angels Clinic Board Vice Chair Donna Herndon.
We have had 28,684 patient visits since the clinic was opened February of 2000.
In 2009, the average cost of an outpatient visit to the hospital without insurance was $642. So the Angels Clinic administered care equivalent to $18 million in the private healthcare industry. This total doesn't take into account the amount of medications dispensed to those who are in need.
We have dispensed $6,958,941 worth of free pharmaceuticals out of the clinic.
Herndon says those meds came from agencies that provide low-cost or free access to some medications. The clinic also cuts costs by using volunteer physicians, pharmacists, and dentists. The clinic, however, does staff an office manager and nurse practitioner. The partner thrift shop raises funds to support much of the staff expenses. Angels Attic co-founder, Rose Albritton, says in 10 years, the Attic's fundraising has exceeded her expectations.
I don't think we ever thought we would have raised over $1.3 million by this point.
This total is staggering when compared to the $20,000 of seed money used to open the shop 10 years ago. Herndon says the Attic now finances 85% of the clinic's operations, keeping those who work but cannot afford the rising cost of health care covered.
There will always be people that fall through the cracks. There will always be people whose needs are not met with existing programs. We don't know exactly how that'll all work out, but we're ready.
Looking to the future, Herndon says the rollout of the Affordable Care Act may change the clinic's clientele, but not its mission. With the Attic behind it, the clinic staff and volunteers will continue focusing on their primary goal, helping people like Kathy Turner. For WKMS, I'm Drew Adams.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, Rose Kristen Presson, and Heidi Couch. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance. If you have any questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks very much for listening.